Welcome to another episode of Subscription Radio. I'm your host, Ben Fisher, aka DJ Fish. With me, I have a very special guest, someone who I've been DMing on LinkedIn for over a year and a half, and finally excited to have him on the show, Rick Watson. Rick, thanks so much for being here. Rick's background, he's been working in technology and e-commerce for the last 20 years, I think before it was even really a thing. And today is focused specifically on working with investors and management teams on incubating and growing D2C businesses. And the reason I came across Rick's work and writing specifically on LinkedIn is he listens to the investor updates for public companies. And so he's going in and doing the work of listening to Shopify's annual reports or quarterly reports and talking about what is the one interesting thing that Toby said, as opposed to what are all the lines that maybe I think you described it as that Harley's sort of the pre-canned answers, and you're listening and sort of picking up on what are the most interesting things that are being said, perhaps even off the cuff in those reports or those talks. Yeah.
Yeah.
So no, super excited to have you on the show, man. And I think part of what's cool is your experience, it's beyond D2C, it's B2B. You're looking at marketplaces, you're thinking a lot about Amazon, and I would imagine just like you're kind of coming into this and thinking about e-commerce and D2C specifically from like looking at a bunch of different marketplaces outside of just Shopify, for example.
Yeah, for sure. First of all, thanks so much, Ben, for having me on. I'm excited to be here.
Let's kick it off with, I started asking this before we even started, was like, so do you have any subscriptions?
Yeah, so I tend not to have a bunch of subscriptions. I think right now the only subscription I maintain is like Cascade Pods or something, you know, just for my dishwasher.
And it's probably not D2C.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's from Amazon. But I mean, for me, the value of a typical subscription is not the challenges. Number one is like, at least for Amazon, the shipping is so fast anyway.
Yeah.
So whenever I need it, I don't feel like I'm going to be out of it anymore because I'm in New York City. I'll get next day shipping pretty much on most things that I want. And the second problem is that I think a lot of subscription brands don't understand is that it's very hard to predict usage patterns. And why do I want product that I don't need?
Mm-hmm.
It's so, particularly like vacation pauses and things like that, it becomes like a new task for me. And
yeah,
you know, I'd rather just reorder when I get back. I could just sort of check the closet and use like almost the last of something. I'll just order the next one rather than subscribe to it.
I'm curious how consumption behavior changed during COVID. We know it accelerated in terms of people just going D2C and buying e-commerce, but because people weren't going on trips as much,
yeah,
my guess is that their consumption patterns were relatively stable. I mean, the amount of coffee you drink, I know for me, it varies.
Right.
Like most shelf stable products are tied, you know, but now that people are nomadic again, or the world's more nomadic or getting more nomadic.
Right. Yeah. We're going out to events and things and we're traveling around. But yeah, I definitely think, you know, there was a period when we weren't going out as much, and then, you know, maybe on the weekends or something just to get out of our houses.
Yeah. Especially in New York, you know, I'd go outside. It was like a ghost town.
Right.
And I felt like I was living in an episode of The Walking Dead.
Yeah. Totally was a zombie apocalypse.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. And so what are some of your own hot takes around like subscription and repeat customers? I think that was one of the trends you and I were talking around. And it's actually, I mean, that's a stat that I've paid really close attention to is, you know, what's the impact of repeat customers versus subscription? I think I know that in all the conversations I have with subscription brands, like the big thing is that the LTV of a subscription customer is so much higher that just from a math, from a math perspective, like
right,
I know a lot of brands that just are like, the only way you can buy a product is subscription because the LTV is just so much higher. Now the flip side and what I say is, well, as a consumer, is that a great experience? And how much money are you leaving on the table from people who just would otherwise be a good customer? And I don't know, I'm curious what your perception is or perspective is on that tension.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I definitely feel like it's very hard to be a subscription only product. Like logically,
right,
it doesn't make sense in the world because everyone needs new customers and they need repeat customers. You need both, right? And so to be a subscription only brand must mean that either you don't have a lot of competition or your customers are very trusting. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like they're not skeptical at all. And so the idea when Folgers Coffee sent like a sample of coffee to every doorstep in America, you know, all these decades ago, there's a reason they did it. You know, they did it is because they wanted to introduce their product to the consumer. They know that someone would go back to the store and buy it, not necessarily because they wanted a lifetime relationship with someone. And I think that's an area I think some brands can get tripped up on. You're like, well, if LTV is my most important metric, then maybe I should only do subscriptions. And that's like saying, I want to build a team, but I don't only want to meet people who are willing to commit to me in the first meeting. And I'm like, well, someone might want to meet you a few times and get to know you before making a longer term commitment. And I think that experience, either kind of the pre-purchase research, trials and samples, multiple usages before they decide, like, this is part of my lifestyle. It's really kind of the pinnacle of the relationship and not necessarily the introduction.
No, 100%. That's interesting. Yeah. I guess the other analogy would be like it's getting married on the first date, right? Or deciding that you want to accept the job after a single conversation.
Right.
But no, it is one of those funny things. And even when I talk to brands, I'm like, especially when around subscription metrics, if someone cancels before they've even received the product, first off, no one's your customer if they've never experienced your product before and they subscribe. They're not your customer until they have renewed, right? Like that is like sort of going back to, you know, this is where cohort analysis and all that stuff matters. But like if no one's experienced the benefit of your product and they bought it, like they're a prospective customer, even that point. And I think it's interesting to look at this idea of who is that type of person who is willing to buy from you, buy a subscription on the first try. And it's probably someone doing it for the discount, A.
100%.
Right. And so when that's one of the interesting things that like when I talk to brands is like I ask them, like, what's your metric of people who subscribe and then cancel before they actually even receive the product? Because what that tells you is those are the people who are doing it just for the discount. There are exceptions where some people just don't want to be automatically charged, like they want to be in control of their credit card. But by and large, it's probably mostly people who saw that it was 20% off if they subscribed and it was easy enough to cancel.
Yeah, I think it's no different than that 20% off if you put in your email address or your SMS number. That's what it is. And like, why wouldn't you try it and then cancel it? And you're betting on that breakage. But is that really how you want to run your business? You know, to tricking someone to not canceling and then getting the second one. So you're creating your funnel in the wrong way is how I would put it. And your funnel should be based on progressive discovery of, okay, yes, you might be vaguely interested. Okay, yes, I'm a little bit more interested. Yes, I'm extremely interested. And I want to make a bigger commitment here. And I'm pretty sure I want to stop using my old brand. Mm-hmm. And I want to start using this coffee brand or whatever it is for a longer period of time. As you become more sure of your decision, not just like, okay, I've been drinking the same coffee for 2 years. I want to drink a new coffee tomorrow, but I want to immediately switch for a year. without trying it.
Yeah, I think that's the interesting, actually a very interesting point is like, how likely is it for someone to have a habit and then immediately be like, I'm going to completely change that habit? The exception, I think, is probably going to the gym. People don't go to the gym for 9 months and then sign up for an annual subscription for their gym.
Yeah.
Except they don't actually have to follow through on the behavior.
Yeah.
But they do make the purchase decision because it's aspirational.
You know, I think other types of subscription businesses, if we're going to talk about a business like Rent the Runway or something like that.
Yep.
It's a subscription business. It's a monthly model. And the subscription is about the variety. And so you're not buying the same dress or the same outfit or the same handbag or whatever every month. You're buying access to a library.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of much like you use Netflix or Spotify. Like I'm not only subscribing to Netflix for Stranger Things. I'm subscribing because I know that next month I'm probably going to want to see something on there too, and the month after and the month after. And Rent the Runway, I think, does a good job of filling that need in a closet for, you know, an important work meeting, an upcoming event, that night out, mm-hmm. where you want some variety in your wardrobe. You can't afford to spend, you know, all your money on the latest brand. And so you're willing to subscribe for that because you know, like, okay, at least 3 or 4 times a month, I just kind of tired of what I do now. It's not like I throw away my wardrobe.
Right.
But there's some freshness there. And you know, it's not just about one brand. You know, there's a much bigger catalog behind it.
Right. No, yeah, right. So the curation, which I guess, it goes back to some of the reasons why. Like, what are the different types of subscriptions? That wouldn't be replenishment. That would be, curation. It's giving you a catalog of products. So I'm curious, can you tell us a little bit about the typical type of D2C brands that you're working with? And like, are there any sort of common themes that you're seeing? And are these predominantly brands that they were retailers and they're moving into D2C? Are they brand new companies that are, we'll call it like D2C is their first channel? Like, what are some of the different types of companies you're working with and like what you're seeing?
Yeah, I would say there are two types of brands, but they all have the common thing between them is that they're generally bigger brands that are retail focused. Mm-hmm. And so they have big retail partners. They might, you know, that might be Walmart. In the baby category, it might be Target and Bye Bye Baby and Walmart. If they're in sporting goods, it might be Dick's Sporting Goods and, you know, and Walmart and Target. So it kind of depends on the category, or there might be a fashion brand where their biggest customer is Macy's today. But their D2C business, whatever, a lot of times these brands that have been around, usually the brands have a history. They're like they've been around for over 20 years and they've gotten to sometimes several hundred million in sales selling through retail, but they've never tried to establish a direct relationship with their consumer. And so, for instance, you know, I was working with Anne Klein a couple of years ago, which was just bought by a new private equity owner, WHP Global, who I'm also an advisor for. And before I started working with them, if you went to AnnKlein.com, you couldn't buy anything there. You couldn't buy.
Right, right.
And so that's one example. It's not the only example, but the point is that you could have a very large business with a nascent D2C business. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be zero. It could be 1 million. It could be 10 million. It could, you know, but the size of the D2C business is like way out of proportion to what a D2C business should be in proportion to a large retail business. So that's one example. I said the other types of brands are more marketplace focused. Mm-hmm. And the reason is, again, kind of similar background to where there are a large brand, they might sell, it could be like white goods, like plumbing supplies. And they sell into Home Depot on those. And they actually have a pretty big Amazon business. Maybe they have a $10, $20, $30 million Amazon business. And they think it has a much bigger potential. Like, we think this could be $150 million. And I might talk to them. It's like, look, this could be a $200 million business for you just on Amazon. Mm-hmm. But they don't have the background to scale the business to that level or understand like what tools and technologies and processes and strategies to do to scale the business that way. And so some of it is education. Some of it is kind of the combination of people, process, and technology. Like right now, usually, if a company has been around for a long time, they're organized a certain way for a reason. It's to fulfill their existing customers. Mm-hmm. And their existing customers are usually big retailers. And so as a result, if there is a direct-to-consumer business, it's usually an afterthought. It's like one or two people off to the side that are not getting very many much resources and attention from the CEO and the investors. And so when I tend to start to work with companies, usually it's because an investor has come in and bought the brand and sees potential. Like, look, every brand online has a big direct-to-consumer business, e-commerce, like let's say in a fashion apparel, should be 50 to 70% of your sales. You should be getting that much from online. And if that number is 5 to 10% for you, then you have a huge opportunity online.
Yeah, that's interesting, I think, especially those brands transitioning. Because as someone who's been in the Shopify ecosystem for a while, almost exclusively the brands that I worked with were brand new subscription, digitally native brands. Yeah, so going back to Shopify, the question had been, or I was saying, a lot of the brands that I've worked with have been predominantly digitally native. And so it's interesting looking at seeing the other side and more brands who never had a subscription piece now incorporating subscriptions. And one of the biggest challenges I've heard over and over again is even if their Shopify business is doing $30 million a year in repeat purchases, they still don't necessarily know how to sell subscriptions on Shopify or like what their subscription strategy is. And so it's funny because even like the challenge is similar. It's like these brands that are retail shifting over D2C, they're trying to figure out how to build their D2C muscle. And then there's D2C brands that have been selling just transactionally.
Right.
And then they're trying to figure out how to do subscriptions.
Right. Yeah, no, exactly. It's a new skill to learn. And so as a result, it's not something that's really on their radar. They're thinking about how do we acquire the customer? How do you get them to your landing page? But then how do you remarket to them in a smart way is usually an afterthought.
And so with these brands that you're working with, what platforms do you typically see them gravitating towards? I assume they don't have engineers in-house, but they are enterprise. And so they're probably being sold to by like Commerce Cloud or whatever. Or are they jumping to something like Shopify Plus?
Yeah, I think Shopify Plus is probably the main one, just because it's so widespread and has the most apps and support and agencies. And so when you talk to customers, you want to bring them to a platform where the people are. And so, especially if this is something new to you, you don't need to reinvent the wheel. And Shopify has invented a pretty good wheel that it's very hard to make a extremely poorly converting Shopify site. I mean, you have to like almost work at it.
Work at it.
In old school e-commerce, just one of the basic things, like no matter what page you land on, you need to be at least three clicks from checkout. Like it's impossible to build a Shopify site that's not three clicks from checkout. It's almost literally impossible. So there's no room in the platform to even just create these strange experiences that used to appear in e-commerce. Every Shopify site kind of looks the same, I'll be honest with you. Mm-hmm. They all have the nav at the top and the categories, and they all have the mega menu now, and they have the testimonials on the landing. Like, so they all kind of look basically the same. And another thing I think that's really important is, like, if they have an agency build their site and they don't like it or something's not working, they need to be able to fire that agency, find another one. And so if you find a site, another technology could work, but you have fewer options with agencies and developer partners. So Shopify is a big one. Salesforce Commerce Cloud definitely comes in, particularly if the customer has, it's kind of a large, like usually a multinational presence. Mm-hmm. It usually comes in, or if they have a big Salesforce CRM investment, a lot of times IT likes to consolidate vendors. So that comes up. BigCommerce comes up still on the B2B side.
Okay.
You know, because Shopify is still pretty new and it's right. B2B technology. They have some app partners that can plug in and help, but now you have two platforms. You have the Shopify platform for direct consumer, and you have this partner that's kind of synchronizing between Shopify, and you're in this awkward situation. Like a lot of people in the Shopify ecosystem get from time to time is you can fill a need in the Shopify ecosystem, but it doesn't really prevent Shopify from doing it themselves later on. And I think B2B is kind of in that situation now. If you search in B2B in the app store, you'll see a lot of apps for like quoting and price lists and all these, you know, negotiation, all these things that are B2B in invoicing terms that are needed by a standard B2B site.
Yeah.
And 2 years, Shopify will have all of them native. You know what I mean? Like you won't need any of these apps. And most of these companies will have to find something else to do.
Yeah. Like I know, I mean, so my wife, she's a home decor designer and has a brand. And so she sells wholesale as well as direct to consumer. And so one of the things when I was setting her up on Shopify was, you know, looking through all the wholesale apps of like, how can her wholesale buyers be able to just log into her Shopify store? And it was all done through random apps. Like I think Wholesale Gorilla is one of them, but there was no way to like do password protection. It was interesting though, because you probably know of Shopify's acquisition of Handshake several years ago for like $200 million or something like that, which was a B2B marketplace that integrated with POS systems. I don't think they've really done much with it, but it has seemed, and you've written even about this yourself, like Shopify has been upping their B2B game, or at least I think what they say they're going to do. But the problem is that there's a million different things that Shopify it seems to need to be doing, whether it's around fulfillment to compete with Amazon, or if it's B2B to deal with like wholesale. Like, no, but I think your point there, I guess what resonated with me was talking about the what is the functionality, even like in the B2B ecosystem of Shopify that right now there's an opportunity for it to exist because Shopify doesn't have it themselves. I certainly navigated this with my previous company, Carthook, where, you know, we were filling a need around that because of what we were building needed to be integrated at the time and place the Shopify checkout because the Shopify checkout couldn't support it. And the Shopify checkout is one of Shopify's, I mean, that's like their crown jewel, right? Where that is the thing that they make their money off payment processing. If you read any of their investor reports, like that is the thing. And so if you're building an app within the Shopify ecosystem, you have to, Shopify will build general, we'll call it like, they'll build the functionality to make it work for 95% of the mass market. You can send emails, email newsletters and stuff through Shopify, yet in spite of that, you have the MailChimp integration, even though it was shut off and now came back. You have Klaviyo that was super successful, probably in part because they were so early in Shopify. But by and large, Shopify has just gone very wide and not very narrow. And so like the opportunities probably in B2B is specific use cases.
Yeah. No, I think that's interesting. And to kind of continue in the platform discussion, another one that comes up, particularly like in the headless space, is somebody like a Commerce Tools.
Yeah.
Where more in the enterprise market, I mean, there've been a lot of noise about headless and what people call headless or not or whatever, but
right.
Commerce Tools is a company that's been doing it for a long time, and they actually have examples of customers that have been successful with it. And I think those types of companies are not like the other companies we talked about before. It's like these companies have their own development teams,
right.
And they want to develop their own technology. And a cloud platform out off the box that kind of fits in a box doesn't really fit their workflow.
Which is interesting because, you know, that's another initiative of Shopify, right? Where they have Shopify Headless, what I think it's called. I keep wanting to say Helium. It's not Helium. It's just like,
it's hydrogen and oxygen.
Hydrogen. Yeah, there we go. Yeah, oxygen is the hosting and then hydrogen's the React.
I can never remember which one is which. Like, it's not clear.
But to your point, what's funny is when people talk about Headless, so like I think Commerce Tools, like there's this whole like mock alliance, which I'm sure you've right? Like so you talk about is like composable commerce, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Where headless is just one like piece of it, but headless is a piece of composable. It is insane though. Like even as an engineer, and I know your background's in engineering, it's like you get to the point of like the nuance where you're like, which version of headless are you talking about? Are you talking about because in a lot of ways I do feel like what headless is doing is it's recreating the Shopify app store. Like the bundling and unbundling, it's on one hand, it makes a lot of sense to have these different systems, or whether it's Commerce Tools or Nacelle or whatever, or Contentful for your CMS that specialize on a very specific piece of the puzzle. But then you end up with 50 different products that are integrated, right?
Right.
And then you're like, I just wish there was one place I could go and do all this. And then you're like, well, there was. And then so Shopify is like this middle ground.
It just
didn't
work for you.
Yeah, you were tired of using a platform that wasn't as flexible. But then Shopify, part of one of the biggest complaints is you have 50 apps to run your store. And so I'm curious to what extent, whether it's composable or mock space, like how much are we just recreating that exact same problem?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think commerce generally, if you kind of look at the last 20 years, there have been a lot of different platforms and they each sort of have their own set of problems.
Yeah.
You know, I would say OS Commerce was probably the first widely deployed, very successful commerce platform. You know, no one remembers it now, but people used it for
years. I don't know. This is like news to me.
People used it like in the early 2000s for years and years. And Magento and their open source site, basically their code base came from a group of OS Commerce developers that got frustrated with it and they wanted a new framework. And so they're like, we want an open, and Red Hat, Linux, and like all the open source movement was really popular in the early 2000s. And so Magento was like, we need to be open source. And cloud wasn't really a major thing.
Mm-hmm.
Cloud was kind of like, even the term is a relatively new term in the last 10 years, I would say. So the original Magento developers, I mean, they just crushed the market. I mean, Magento just came out and everybody was on Magento for years and years until...
And then they couldn't get off.
And then they can't get off Magento. And then Magento was really good for a lot of things, but it also had a bunch of big problems. And actually, the first time I ever heard the term headless was in regards to Magento, because the front end was so non-performant with any number of SKUs, like over 10,000 SKUs or something. The index would fall apart.
Uh-huh.
And you couldn't customize it without breaking the platform. So all this back to cloud is that Commerce Tools is trying to create this cloud-based APIs to connect to these various vendors for your different pieces of your stack. And I think they're trying to do it in a way that's easier to maintain than hosting it all yourself, which is how people used to do it, you know, over 10 years ago with like Oracle ATG and Magento and, you know, et cetera.
Yeah.
Like no one wants to do their own hosting anymore.
Well, because the worst possible thing is to have your checkout or your site go down, right? And what are you going to do? Monitor your site? And I think we've gotten to a point where you just expect it to work. You don't expect to have to be managing it. So I guess of all the different, we were talking about sort of, I mean, the different efforts of Shopify and, you know, subscriptions is obviously a piece of that. But then we also have these brands that are coming in from traditional retail and they're choosing their cloud provider. You know, I guess what are some of the top of mind things for you when you're talking to these brands? Are they struggling with deciding which platform it is, or is it more nuanced around like, how do we even build a direct to consumer capability in the first place? Or is it all the above?
I think there are a couple of different things. They were like, if we're going to go direct to consumer, how much is it going to cost? That's a big question. when are we going to recoup our investment? So like, if we build the team and we get this technology and we get the agency to do it, and then we do digital marketing and then we add these apps and plugins, like, when do we get our money back? And so that's definitely something that's on their minds. I think if it's like a marketplace customer, it's a lot more about like, how do I maximize my potential? I think there are times I even get brought in on a Shopify site where you have an agency that's managing 5 to 10 brands. And they're like, you know, we have a Shopify site, but it was built by this developer. They're not very sophisticated. And we really need you to look in at our set of sites and like benchmark us against the top sites out there. What should be our default app stack? What should our purchase flow look like? Take our product pages and our structure and just like really just audit us from end to end, not only from a path to purchase point of view, but from a shipping and returns and analytics and digital marketing aspect. And so the types of folks who are coming to me, one of the questions is like, how do I compare is a common question because they're wanting to know what they're missing. I won't say it's FOMO, but the more corporate word for it is kind of benchmarking.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, how does my site benchmark against my peer set and or best in class in other categories? And so if, for instance, if you're like a company that sells baby formula, for instance, and you don't have a subscription product, that's a problem, right? Because that's a replenishable product. It's in high demand. You're going to need it. And it's a big opportunity you're leaving on the table. So I think a lot of it depends on the category of product and kind of what's needed, what their peers are doing. What their peers aren't, like sometimes it's not just about comparing them to their peers. You're just imagining what should be possible, even if their peers aren't doing it yet, which gives them opportunities to take market share if their competitors are not paying attention.
And so are you doing all of this analysis? Because I mean, like you talked about like a dozen different topics, each of which, I mean, are even in themselves like specialties, right? Whether it's conversion rate optimization, call it competitive intelligence around and benchmarking, or are you looking at, are you finding like third-party resources?
Yeah.
I'm just curious about how your own approach is and like what is beyond being able to synthesize all this? Like what's your superpower? Like what is it that you love to do?
I mean, ultimately I love analyzing situations, solving problems, and I love putting together great teams to do that well. And so part of my work is not just me, Rick Watson, doing all this on my own. Whereas a lot of consulting firms are kind of teams of a few senior people and then teams of MBAs that are fresh out of school that you're kind of going to get on a project. The way my firm works is because I've been in e-commerce for 20 years, I have a lot of people that I know and trust.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are independents and they like working on their own, but they don't like selling new projects. Some of them have like boutique agencies, but they're really experts and I trust them a lot. But they're happy to be included on a new engagement. So I might work with a small agency for some part of a project, and they might work with me and another person that they've never met before. But I kind of put that team together as sort of one face to the customer to deliver the ultimate solution of what they're looking for, which is kind of what is one coherent plan to make this possible. So
got it. Yeah. So it's like the film industry or like you're building the A-team that's crafted specifically for them.
It's 100% like the A-team. I think, I'm a little bit like a casting director at times. And so like one of the things I love to do is just like when I meet someone, it's just trying to understand what they're great at and what they love to do. And so, I have a CRM database with hundreds of people and what they like to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, I have a little check mark and something like, could I work with this person in the future? Maybe so, maybe not. Sometimes I'll meet a person and then the next week I'll meet a client that needs that skill. And so you never know who you're going to meet if you're going to work with them again. And that's another reason I love e-commerce so much is it seems like a big thing, but it's also a very small community such that you can work with the same people for many years. And if you have a good reputation, then they'll want to keep working with you. You know what I mean? Like you have to pretend that the person you meet is you're going to need them somehow in 5 years from now and enjoy working with them. So I find that to be true much more often than it's not true.
I mean, I have to imagine that's true for a lot of industries as well. And I think what's cool is seeing people choose an industry to stay in. So for me, it was originally I was building B2B SaaS companies. And then as an engineer, like I struggled to figure out like a sustainable business model because there was a lot of great product ideas. And so eventually I was like, you know what? E-commerce, if you can help people figure out how to make more money, then e-commerce is like a very good place just to be like, let's focus right. on that as sort of a greenfield category.
Just stick there for a long time.
Yeah, it's like eliminating variables. Okay, well, if we need to have a sustainable business model, let's find a place where people are making money, and then let's build tools that help them make more money. Right. And then that aligning incentives, as opposed to building Twitter, where you're like, well, I actually don't know if I'll be able to ever monetize this unless we get to scale and then have ads. And then even then, Elon Musk will attack me.
No, it's a good idea. Yeah, I wouldn't want to be in Twitter's position.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
It's hilarious.
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of like other topics for us to talk about, like, is there anything else that's top of mind for you?
Some of the biggest topics I write about a lot is it's just supply chain, like what Shopify is doing in fulfillment. Why is Shopify going into fulfillment at all?
Right.
I think is an interesting question. The short answer is, I think Shopify has an interesting view of the world. The way I think Shopify views the world is like from Toby's original mindset when he set up his snowboard company.
Snowboard shop?
Yeah, snowboard shop, like Snow Devil or something. He basically said, I had to jump through these 200 hoops just to get a transacting website. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to create this site that you could set up in an afternoon or a weekend. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the, I would say, great guiding principles of Shopify that has enabled so much success for them. And so I think what they see in fulfillment is that kind of situation, just in a different part of e-commerce. So they were like, as my business grows, if I manufacture a product, what does it take to me for fulfill it? It's like, well, I need to interview carriers. I need to, you know, figure out packaging. I need to figure out labor. I need to understand any customs information. How am I going to print labels? Like, does my staff show up on time? How do I organize my warehouse? Like, how do I make sure my inventory? Like, the questions are endless in sort of the back, what happens after an order is placed, essentially, in e-commerce, particularly as you scale, because the questions change as you get more volume. Mm-hmm. And so I think Shopify is really interested in that category of merchant that starts small and keeps growing. Mm-hmm. And so if you kind of view Shopify as like the company that tries to apply the easy button to sort of a new section of it, I think that's how they think of supply chain. You know, the big question for them is they don't know it yet. Like, they don't know anything about fulfillment because that's not their background. That's not Toby's background. Basically, you have an entire company of software engineers. And so I think the big question for Shopify is going to be, who is guiding their supply chain strategy and right. what are they going to decide to do?
Yeah.
So
I recall you were expressing concern that they didn't have like a chief supply chain officer or a fulfillment officer before their acquisition of Deliver, right?
Yeah. It's a question mark. It's not an unsolvable question, but it is a question as an outsider, something I would want, like, you know, if I were on Shopify's board of directors, which I am clearly not, it would be a question I would ask. And so it's a fun conversation because Shopify is a very, you know, software is high margins, mm-hmm. you know, and shipping is not, you know, essentially mm-hmm. the only way you make money in shipping is in the label printing. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much like running a 3PL is a barely break-even business, essentially. And so what you're reselling is essentially shipping rates, more or less. And so how is that going to work is a question. And in particular, Shopify doesn't want to own any of the infrastructure.
Right.
How are they going to compete with Amazon level service? So that's going to be fun to watch. And I think subscriptions actually plays a big part in supply chain, because I think the great thing about subscriptions from a supply chain point of view is the ability to predict demand. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I just saw this morning that Chewy had their like first profitable quarter ever. And you want to know what the reason why?
Subscriptions.
Subscriptions. You know the answer. 71% of their revenue comes from subscriptions.
What's the percentage?
71.
71? Yeah. I'd say 71%. Most brands I talk to, it's about, like with most D2C brands that I've talked to, it's around 50-50. It varies, but yeah, it was one of those things I've been curious about, especially as a brand scales and gets to the point of even being public. I guess you could find out, but like, what is that healthy benchmark? Because I will say, going back to like the flexibility part, as someone coming from B2B SaaS, when I think of subscription and I think of recurring revenue, I think of, you're thinking of actual recurring revenue. The thing about CPG and replenishment is, well, I can still skip. I can do a lot of things. And
yeah.
So this isn't Netflix.
It may not be recurring.
Right. And I think that's actually one of the sort of weird illusions and challenges of a lot of operators is, especially when you get to a certain level of scale, like if I were to ask a brand, how often do people skip? they probably wouldn't know. And because once you're at that point where there's enough noise, because I will tell you, if you have 100,000 subscribers and I were to ask you, what's your revenue? And if, let's say, the average order value is, let's say, $1, are you making $100,000 a month if you have 100,000 monthly subscribers? And it's like, well,
right.
There's no way.
Yeah.
And B, you know, people are, but that's one of those metrics where, especially around, I think, getting VC valuations and wanting to get your valuation pegged onto MRR and ARR, it's like, well, if it's not actually recurring, if it's not actually predictable, like at a certain scale, you know, it's predictable within a margin of error. So for all intents and purposes, it is predictable revenue.
But it's not B2B SaaS predictable.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't have service level contracts with your consumers.
No, you don't. No, 100% you don't.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it can't be valued at the same, you know, multiple as SaaS revenue. I totally agree. That's a super interesting point. I you know, you don't think about a lot because you think about, oh, like, well, there's a software to subscription and now you can just subscribe to a CPG brand.
Right.
But they're very different. Like what that subscription means is very different.
And I think what's also interesting, even thinking about Shopify, like, because I would argue they're really a fintech company now, right? I don't know if you know offhand what percentage of their revenue is from payment processing now.
It's like 2/3, something like that. They have subscription solutions and then merchant solutions.
Services,
merchant solutions is basically like 2/3 of their revenue. That includes App Store revenue, which is, I'm sure, large too. Yeah, it's by far the fastest. It's going like at least twice as fast as the subscription business. You know, the monthly fees and the, or the Shopify Plus fees or whatever.
Which is based off of GMV, but that's not, again, like even when I think about it, like fintech, your payment processing is not predictable revenue. It's based off of your volume, which great is you have natural expansion revenue.
Your GMV.
But also there's going to be, none of it's predictable. None of it is guaranteed or none of it's recurring.
It's smart for Shopify. Look, Shop Pay was a genius idea for Shopify.
Yeah.
And it's really powered the growth of their business. And if they did not have Shop Pay, then they would look a lot more like BigCommerce that is just kind of putting along with monthly subscription fees for mostly small merchants. They're not paying the whole company a whole lot at the end of the day.
No. But I guess what you were saying was interesting in, about fulfillment, where you were talking about there's no money in the actual, like, 3PL. Like, they just basically make no money.
Yeah.
But it reminds me of Amazon's model, right? Where AWS is their profit center.
Yeah,
and they basically use it as arbitrage. They use one profitable part of their business to subsidize the other parts of their business, but they use it as, it's a part of a flywheel, right?
Yeah.
And so with Shopify, my assumption is, going back to your point around software, using the profitable parts of Shopify to subsidize the unprofitable pieces, but still make Shopify an attractive place for someone to go and grow. I think it'll be interesting to me, and I don't have an answer at all, of, you know, what does Shopify look like around distribution of, like, early stage stores versus later stage? I think there's a general, like, I think relatively speaking, their Plus offering has grown faster in the last year than their non-Plus. The actual value of Plus has been pretty questionable as an engineer. Like, there were certain features that you could only get on Plus that you couldn't get. And now, which actually has always been slightly infuriating, because I'm like, these are features that anyone should be able to use.
Right.
So the question becomes, how can you make Plus really valuable beyond, like, throttling API calls? Because that's not a good experience.
That's not the experience that they want, 100%. And I think what Shopify has settled on is, like, okay, Plus is, you're going to get our connection of ERP libraries, you know, to, like, NetSuite and Oracle and Microsoft. And, oh yeah, small brand isn't going to have an ERP system. So that makes sense. And then, but at the end of the day, it's really about the support. You know, a big brand is going to expect big support. And so I think when you ask most people, what is Shopify Plus for? It's like being able to get someone on the phone. That's it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That's the most important thing by far.
Yeah. And I think in some cases, renegotiating your payment processing fees, right? Which again is something that happens at scale.
Right.
But, like, by and large, I'm happy to see that some of the functionality that was exclusive to Plus has started to, like, come to, like, more the advanced plan.
Right.
But yeah, it's tough. Like, I had a conversation actually about subscriptions with a brand that I'm friendly with, their VP of growth. We were talking about subscriptions and, like, how insane it is. We were talking about, like, membership and subscriptions, and we were like, this idea of charging a membership to get, like, 2-day shipping. His position was, a great brand experience would be to give your best customers 2-day shipping. Why do they have to pay more just to get 2-day shipping? And I thought that was an interesting idea where he was saying a lot of the things that we take for, or that brands are trying to charge for. And, you know, like the natural example is Amazon Prime, where, yeah, you get second day or 2 day shipping, but you also get a catalog of Amazon videos as well as like a bunch of other perks.
Right.
But yeah, when you think about what are the benefits you can give to a brand that are actually worth the consumer paying for that they shouldn't just get as a perk of being a loyal customer.
Right.
Like, what are those ones that are worth paying for? If you have a point of view or thought any of that.
The problem with Amazon's first mover advantage and its flywheel is that once it starts to establish something, it's very hard to follow them because they build up this natural moat. And to your point about, it's very expensive for a consumer to have multiple programs. And so if every Walmart customer also shops at Amazon, but the reverse is not true, then if I'm already shopping on Amazon, why do I also need a Walmart Plus subscription is a big problem for Walmart. And I think their answer right now is not fantastic. It's like you get cheaper gas is kind of the biggest benefit, which Amazon can't really give you. So they picked the one thing that Amazon can't really access, which kind of makes sense. So I think most brands don't have like Amazon level scale. So, you know, again, it kind of goes back to the Rent the Runway example. Mm-hmm. You know, if I know I'm going to need 3 to 5 things from this company every month, then a subscription makes sense for a service that would otherwise I would have to pay on a per use basis. And so that subscription is a game of relative value. And in some ways, it's a marketing trick. I mean, it literally is a marketing trick. Like Jeff Bezos admitted that the Prime price was made up. It's like $89. We thought that was a good number. And, you know, I guess he was right, you know. So
yeah. Well, I mean, there's a lot of like you paid for it. So is it like a not sunk cost fallacy?
Now you have to use it.
Yeah. But like it justifies in your own brain, like in advertising, it's getting a commitment. And so that when you think of it, like, yeah, well, I already paid the $89, so I'll think about it. Well, Rick, I'm respectful of your time. Thanks so much for coming on. I was going to say one question I like to ask at the end of the show is like, do you have a big ask like for anyone listening? Is like, is there one thing that would transform your life or your business that you could just kind of put out into the world and maybe someone can help you?
Oh, wow. No, I mean, I don't have a big ask for other people. You know, I would love to just communicate something back to the listeners, really. And I think one of the things that I really believe in my life is just the value of consistency, is the value of waking up every day and keeping your head down and just focusing on what you're doing, whether it's content or prospecting or marketing or improving your product, you know, improving your customer's experience. Really have a plan and prioritize how you're spending your time every day. And just making sure that the people that you yourself and the people you're working with, unless you're the boss, you can't control that. So don't focus so much on what someone else is not doing that's next to you. Focus more on what you're doing and how you're working to improve the experience, because your behavior rubs off on other people. We're kind of a tribal species that way. And so, you know, people can create the culture in their own company. So that's just something I wanted to pass along.
That's great. That's the first time when I've asked that question that someone's actually reversed it and been like, actually, what I'd love is more peace in the world. No, but thank you. And what's the best place for people to keep track and follow your writing? I assume LinkedIn.
Yeah, LinkedIn is probably the best place to find me. Just search for Rick Watson on LinkedIn. I also have a podcast that I produce weekly. It's called the Watson Weekly Podcast. It's a quick 10 to 15 minutes of digest of the week's e-commerce news and my analysis there. But happy to hear for anyone to reach out. Just DM me on LinkedIn or contact me via my website, which is rmwcommerce.com.
Awesome. And we'll put all these links into the show notes to all those different places. But Rick, thanks so much for coming on. I think as we were talking, I kept thinking of more topics I'd like to talk to you about. So maybe we can have you back on the show at some other point, or no, because this was a lot of fun.
Thanks a lot. No, I appreciate the time, Ben.